airfare in the biggest little city in the world. Yes, that's Reno, Nevada. The first prize is a night out on Burnside with a night at the Jupiter Hotel, with dinner at Le Pigeon, drinks at Cider Riot, and breakfast at Grendel, so you can dive deep into the Burnside nightlife. And our second prize will allow you to stock up on medicinal and recreational treats at Jane PDX. Go to kboo.fm to donate. When we come together, we build our community's resilience, and there's no better time to invest in KBOO than now.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from True West, presenting the American Jazz Fusion and Latin Jazz guitarist Al Dimeola, September 13th at Revolution Hall. Tickets and information for Al Dimeola on his Elegant Gypsy 40th Anniversary Electric Tour in Portland on Wednesday, September 13th are available at revolutionhall.com.
Well, good morning. Today we're going to talk about Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is sort of a pillar of the establishment in foreign policy affairs, who I believe he passed away earlier this year. Brzezinski was born in Poland in 1928, and his father was a diplomat and who was posted during the 30s. Brzezinski's father was posted first to Germany and then to the Soviet Union. So young Zbigniew, as a child, he witnessed the rise of Hitler and the great purges in the Soviet Union later in that decade. Then later on, and near the end of the decade, around 1938, Brzezinski's father was posted to Canada, and I think that's where they stayed for quite a while. Zbigniew Brzezinski went to Harvard, and he got a PhD there in 1953, and he became a U.S. citizen in 1958. And he also joined the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group, and I think he helped put together the Trilateral Commission. So you can see that Zbigniew Brzezinski was very well connected. He was considered a pillar of the foreign policy establishment. He also, like many others back in those days, he supported the Vietnam War. And then he became President Jimmy Carter's foreign policy advisor. And that's where Brzezinski's bright idea for Afghanistan came about. What he did, he supported the Islamic Mujahideen against the Soviets. And the idea was to give them a taste of their own Vietnam. Now, a lot of people think that this aid, the Mujahideen, began after the Soviets invaded. And that is not really true. And for that, we go to an interview that Brzezinski gave to the French journal Nouvel Observateur in 1998. And he was asked about that, and Brzezinski said, according to the official version of history, CIA aid to Mujahideen began during 1980. That is to say, after the Soviet Army invaded Afghanistan, 24 December 1979. But the reality, secretly guarded until now, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. Now, that is Brzezinski himself quoted in Le Nouvel Observateur. Then he was asked, basically, he was asked if he regrets anything about that move. And this is what Brzezinski has to say. Regret what? That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap, and you want me to regret it? The day that the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War. Indeed, for almost 10 years, Moscow had to carry on a war unsupportable by the government, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and finally the breakup of the Soviet Empire. Further on, Brzezinski asked, what is most important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire, some stirred-up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? That is Brzezinski himself admitting that this aid to the Mujahideen began before the Soviet invasion. And it's very interesting that the Nouvelle Observateur, they published two editions, and the version that goes to the United States is shorter than the French version. And so it's possible that this part of the interview was not included in the shorter version. This comes from the French version, which is translated by Bill Bloom, if you want to look it up. So there we have it. The reason that when we consider aid to these Mujahideen, they included some of the warlords and the jihadists and outside people coming in, like guess who? Osama bin Laden. That's where he kind of began his career, really, his political career. And let's remember that Brzezinski sort of thought up this idea, but let's remember that President Carter signed off on it. Now, Carter has a reputation for being a pretty good president, you know, a right-thinking president, especially after, you know, his work that he's done since he left office. But he did go along with this. He signed off on it. So lesson number one is that the establishment has given us an ongoing disaster. This happened in 1980, 1979, and it's been endless war in Afghanistan ever since. It's been, my gosh, was that 40 years, 30 years ago? And it spread. The Islamic jihadists who went into Afghanistan, they have spread their influence throughout the Middle East for other reasons, too. And I would say that this kind of interference that we have done has led to Kim Jong-un's H-bomb. The war in Afghanistan was followed by the Iraq invasion, which led to the Islamic State. You remember when the Islamic State first appeared on the scene? They came down this desert road in brand new Toyota pickup trucks, brand new, with little machine guns mounted in the back. Where did they come from? Who bought them? Well, probably the Saudis bought them. This sort of leads to another bright idea that many people have considered, using head choppers like Islamic State against our enemies, namely Syria, Iran, and Russia. One example of that is there's an article in this is from the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, and a professor, Ephraim Inbar, this is from last year, August last year, says that the destruction of Islamic State is a strategic mistake. And he advocated keeping groups like Islamic State around. Don't get rid of them. Keep them around because they may come in handy against your enemies sometime. And I think he was thinking more of Iran. And it's not just professors like that. I believe General Petraeus was voicing similar ideas, and many others too. So that is sort of a little history of bright ideas. But this goes back earlier. It doesn't begin in 1979 because there are earlier moves by the U.S. and the West against democratic secular rulers. Syria in 1949 had an elected president. We overthrew him. He did get back in power later on, but we tried again in 1956 to overthrow him. In 1953, we overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran, Mossadegh. In 1959, we hired a young thug named Saddam Hussein to assassinate the leader of Iraq, Abdel Karim Qasem, who was probably the last honest ruler Iraq ever had. That particular attempt failed, but a few years later they did get rid of Karim Qasem, and Saddam Hussein took over in Iraq. In Egypt in 1966, we supported the Muslim Brotherhood against Nasser. So this is kind of a recurring theme where the U.S. and the West has actively chosen religious fanatics against democratic, possibly, well, secular rulers, who some of whom were democratic and some of whom may not have been, but against leftist secular rulers. Lesson number two is that it wasn't for democracy. The Soviet Union did collapse in 1989, 1991, but not enough, apparently, at least not enough for the U.S. Under President Boris Yeltsin, collapse is well on the way. Insiders in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, they sold the nation's assets very cheap to Western interests. And these guys became sort of the first oligarchs. I think now there are well over 100 oligarchs around. They're all fantastically wealthy. And these first ones, they got wealthy by selling out their own country to the West, and with disastrous results. The Soviet the Russian economy really collapsed. Life expectancy went way down. It was just a terrible time for ordinary people. But Yeltsin, his drinking got too much for him, and he left office, I believe, in the year 2000, and Vladimir Putin was put in his place. And Putin called a halt to all this. Apparently his deal was that he allowed the oligarchs to keep their wealth if they would keep it at home, where it would be of some use to the Russian nation. Other oligarchs, they left. Khodorkovsky comes to mind. He was actually put in prison for tax evasion or something. And so you sort of have the oligarchy is divided into sort of two groups, the anti-Putin guys who have come to the West and the ones who stayed in Russia in a kind of uneasy relationship with Putin, because there are signs that he may be going after them one by one. But that was what Russian democracy was all about. And Putin put a stop to it, and you could say that the West has hated this guy ever since. That was the beginning of it, because before that, they probably didn't be our leaders, probably weren't aware of even who he was. It's very interesting that Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, and it was all about sort of strategy in what he called the Eurasian Balkans. And he had the idea that, and it turned out to be kind of true, that the Soviet Union, that when it broke up, it would break up on national lines, which he was kind of in favor of happening. So you have the Soviet Union broke up, and now you have, besides Russia, you have Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all these countries. And later on, Brzezinski, at first he had the idea that that the U.S. could kind of get its own way all by itself in this kind of chessboard landscape. But then he had a reality kind of changed his mind a little bit, that the U.S. had to work with other nations. And as a leader, of course, but that he had it, that we had to take, their opinions and interests into account. But that was Brzezinski, but that was not true of everybody in the Washington establishment. We have, I call them the America supremacists, also known as the neocons or the War Party. And their ideas haven't changed at all. They want to get Russia. Russia is the grand prize. For example, the head of the U.S. AID, I think it's Carl Gershman, has said that the ultimate prize is to get a regime change in Russia. Well, the obvious, Russia, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has political parties, it has a press, it has people who criticize Putin, maybe not as much as we would like. It's obviously the Russians themselves realize that their democracy needs quite a bit of work. And but it is, they do have democratic institutions, they do have elections where votes are counted, and the real meaning of all this is that if you want to help Russia become a democracy, you don't do it by surrounding them with military bases and threatening to overthrow what democracy they have. Better to leave them alone and let them develop. That's how most nations, if they're lucky, develop their democracies, by being left in peace to work out their own affairs. So that's lesson two. Democracy didn't count for very much to our leaders, although they talk about it a lot. Lesson three is that it's all about geography and resources. And Brzezinski he was very impressed by what they call the heartland theory, which was sort of thought up by a British intellectual about 100 years back, around the turn of the 20th century, a man named Halford Mackinder. And his idea was that the Eurasian continent, he called it the world island, and that it dominates the world. Whoever rules this world island kind of rules the world. And if we look back at history, for much of history, the richest powers were in Asia, specifically China. And the European dominance was only temporary. It came about starting around 1500 or so, and it was based on control of the seas, where the British and the Portuguese explorers, they sailed around the world and picked up colonies in what was known then to many as the Second World, the whole Western Hemisphere, which is rich in resources. And the U.S. finally got other countries are involved in the looting of the Western Hemisphere, namely Spain and Portugal and England and France. But it was really the U.S. that sort of inherited the resources, fantastic amount of oil and rich land and everything else. And it was a bonanza. It was like a 400-year bonanza. They raided nature's treasury. This oil had been sitting there for millions of years. It took millions of years for it to be formed, and we have basically used it up. We have squandered it. Back in 1859, when the first commercial oil well in Pennsylvania came online, they struck oil at 69 feet. Since then, we've had these big gushers in Texas and Oklahoma where you drill down a ways and just oil comes spouting out in huge plumes. Well, it didn't take much effort to get that oil, but now we have to go under we have to drill down below the oceans, horizontal drilling, fracking, all this extra work just to get a diminishing amount of oil. And so we have largely used that up. We talk of some of our leaders talk about America being an oil exporter. Well, we do export some oil, but we also import more oil. We are a net importer of oil. And because of geology, because of the fact that we have gotten the easy oil first, the tough oil remains, and it is a diminishing supply. So the U.S. has squandered its cheap oil. Russia still has a lot of theirs. So this Eurasian world island is kind of forming up again with economic exchanges and business dealings between Russia and China, plus other countries, all those Turkic nations, the Afghanistan and Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. Also included in this is Iran. So there are other countries getting in on this. And so this world island is slowly forming and is kind of on the way to eclipsing the United States. In order to get the oil, when we started importing oil, we imported most of it from Saudi Arabia. And we made a devil's deal with Saudi Arabia. This is a country ruled by a kind of a huge crime family of 5,000-6,000 princes who live lavishly while the ordinary Arabians live not very well at all. But we made a kind of a devil's deal with Saudi Arabia that we would import their oil, we would protect them, and we would sort of support their interests. Well, they are ruled by a crime family that embraces a very, very strict version of Islam, the Wahhabi version. And with their money, they have spread their message all around the Middle East, setting up schools and madrasas and mosques and everything. They have a lot of influence. And their kind of religious teaching have led to jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda, which was bin Laden's enterprise. And he directly led to the Islamic State. A lot of people talk about this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Well, if you just look at a quick look at those two nations, will tell you which one is more of a democracy. Maybe Iran has many imperfections, but they do have elections where people get to vote, and their votes matter somewhat. You know, they do change things. Think of the change after Mr. Ahmadinejad was voted out of office and Rouhani was voted in. And so the U.S. made this deal, and so we are stuck with this. We have to support the Saudis for all their nasty doings. And part of the deal was that the Saudis would sell their oil only for dollars. So any country in the world that wanted to buy Saudi Arabian oil had to accumulate dollars first, and then use those dollars to buy the oil. And so this sort of buoys up the dollar economy, and it allows the U.S. to, the way you buy a dollar, if you're a ruler of some other country, you buy treasury bonds. So basically these other countries are lending resources to the U.S. in order to buy dollars so they can import oil. So the U.S. has got the benefit of these sort of cheap loans. We've had trade deficits now for many, many years, and they happen because of this arrangement that we have made with the Saudi rulers. Well, that is coming to an end also. We have this new formation, this Eurasian, the Chinese call it the New Silk Road, and the Russians have their own economic union, which are kind of merging together, and they are forming they have their own development bank. They have been buying up gold for the last several years, and they are launching a kind of an international, the Chinese currency is a yuan, and they are launching that on the international level, which is backed by gold. So, in other words, if a country wants to, they can make an arrangement with China, and they can buy oil using the Chinese yuan, which in effect is gold because it can be exchanged for gold at any time. That is what the Chinese are proposing. We will see how far that goes. So that is sort of what Brzezinski's bright idea has wrought, and what the U.S. empire, which seems to be sputtering out now with the election of Donald Trump, and it's... Among other things, this petroleum economy has brought us a climate breakdown. It's very interesting that Houston, there's, I think, 15 refineries have been damaged by the most recent hurricane. And so you have the climate breakdown was largely caused by this petroleum economy. Millions of cars all around the world using belching hydrocarbons into the air, changing the climate, and now the climate breakdown has struck home right in the heartland of it, Houston and the Gulf Coast with all those oil rigs. And so it's kind of a sort of a horrible cosmic joke here. But how can, you might ask, as the oceans rise, our economy, the economy of the West, is 400-year rule by the West was based on navigation of the seas. And how can we have world trade when all our seaports are flooded? This is kind of in the works right now. People are really wondering what's going to happen when Hurricane Irma hits Miami. Will we see pictures of Donald Trump mopping up the floors at Mar-a-Lago? I don't know. It could be even worse than that. And so this is sort of these policies have been around for a while. They were supported by all our so-called reasonable, realistic, rational leaders who were concerned about democracy, and we can see what it has led to. It's been a failure, and it looks to me like the world is reverting to a kind of what it was before the West began its rise. And sort of the equation here is that the U.S., which has about 5% of the world's population, produces half the world's solid waste. That's from the Scientific American magazine, and about 25% of its fossil fuels. So considering the world, we are grabbing much more than our share, and we are producing much, much more than our share of garbage. And that is coming to an end. So stay tuned, folks, because history keeps on going no matter what our leaders think and say. Stay tuned because some... stay tuned for Air Cascadia, followed by Flashpoints, and then Between the Covers and Black Book Talk on KBOO, your radio station.
Yes, good morning. KBOO Portland is your community radio. A couple minutes before 10 o'clock, and then at we've got 10:15 Flashpoints with your host, Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today, join us for Between the Covers, Jacqueline Woodson's latest novel, Another Brooklyn, is a poetic tale of four African-American girls growing up in 1970s New York. And then today at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. And on today's show, Portland novelist Renee Watson talks about her new collaboration, Before Betty X, about the early life of Malcolm X's wife. That's all coming up this morning. We do have Air Cascadia up next. Chris Andre with headlines, interviews, and commentary coming right up. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th. Through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. The Ingenio Milagro Playfest will feature four plays by Latinx playwrights and a concert readings over 3 days after a short rehearsal period. The playwrights will also get to work with the guest artist Daniel Jacquez. Again, that's Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast.